It's an interesting life that we live, and we have so many choices. So I just want to make choices that make better sense to how and are related to how I feel. And I used to try to live my life from what I thought was right and wrong. And now I'm more inclined to live my life from how does it feel inside of me? And by that I mean when something happens, I'm trying to own what I think about it. And then how I feel about what I thought. And if it feels good, you know, I'll do more of it. And if it doesn't feel so good, I'll try to soften it and sort of move into something that feels a little better.
Hello and welcome to the last episode of season two of Lori's Hands Community Voices. I'm your host, Jennifer McCord. All season, we have been hearing from clients of Lori's Hand's newest chapter in Baltimore, Maryland. Each week, we hear from a different client about their life, their stories, and their community. And this week, you'll meet Marguerite Woods. I interviewed Marguerite with the help of Dami Lola Shabby, a media and communications student at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, or UMBC. Here's Dami Lola.
Marguerite is an activist. Like, I feel like the first one that came to my mind is like strong-willed. I feel like she tried to talk about her life, but also in a way to teach others about what they can do in their own lives. Like kind of being a teacher in some way, or like trying to inspire good things in other people. But I feel like it was a peek into like how she looks at the world and her care for others and what she is able to do. Marguerite has agency about everything in her life.
Enjoy.
I am Marguerite Woods, and of course that's my name, and many facets of who I am, many stages I've been through, and when I think about myself these days, I think of the fact that I'm Black, I am bald, I am blind, I'm beautiful, and I'm bold. I am a family member, I'm a sister, a mom, and I am an advocate for blind, I was going to say issues, but I don't really mean issues, blind desires. Things that support people dealing with blindness so that they can live independently and be a viable part of society. I'm also an advocate for older adults and just seeing older adults as assets to the community, you know, helping older adults recognize it in themselves and helping the rest of the community to recognize it as well. And I like connecting with people and talking with people from different backgrounds and cultures. I enjoy traveling, and I love art. I like music. When I was sighted, I loved visiting museums. And as a blind person, I started to recognize that those things can be available for my enjoyment with just a few considerations. When I became blind, as a matter of fact, one of the things that I recognized that it was important for me to find things to do that could soothe me because it was an anxious time. And I had an opportunity to be in India for a while. And while I was there, I did a workshop and got an opportunity to put my hands in some clay. And it was so soothing for me. I made a mental note that when I came back to the States, I was going to look for clay classes. So I was able to find classes and found an instructor that wasn't afraid to teach a blind person. Baltimore Clay Works, because I was the first student that they'd had that was blind, they started asking me if I would teach a class of their teachers and help them understand how to relate to a blind student. So because I thought that a practical experience always really kind of brings it home for everybody. I wanted those instructors to teach me a skill that I did not already have. I was a hand crafter and not a wheel thrower. And so I wanted them to teach me how to throw clay on the wheel. And it was very interesting because they had to think about it. And what could they say to me so that I could get a visual of what they were talking about? First of all, you know, they had to show me what the wheel itself was all about, you know, what the seating was like and the pedals. And of course, I touched everything. They would explain it to me, I would touch it, and then I would give them back what I thought they were saying. So once I got comfortable, they gave me some clay and let me play with the pedal so that I could cause the wheel to move. I could get comfortable with how fast it was going or how to slow it down. What it felt like finding the center, feeling the grooves in the wheel so that I could figure out where the center of it was. Putting water on the clay so that it had a certain feel, a certain consistency. Using the sponge and how to use the tools. And so I would try certain things and you know, they would let me know if I was getting close to what they were asking me to do, if I were not. You know, different teachers would give me information trying to help me understand it. And of course, some of them they would be better at it than others, but everybody was learning about it. And it was really fascinating. How that all worked out. And so at the end of the night, I ended up actually throwing a piece of clay and creating a cylinder. I didn't get much height, but for me to even get what I got was huge for the very first time. And so that helped a lot of teachers, you know, just really have an experience of how important it is to pay attention, to think about it. You know, they're used to showing people, not articulating it. And so that worked out tremendously well. That's become quite a hobby for me. I've created quite a few pieces and even had an opportunity to have some of my work in a gallery. And so that's become an important part of my life as well. I grew up as a sighted person, and so just like, you know, many sighted people, I never really thought about, you know, what it meant to be a blind person and what that, you know, all entailed. I just kind of, you know, glossed over it and even in many ways was happy that I was not blind. It's like I'm glad that's not what I have to deal with, and not even knowing exactly what that meant, it just meant it didn't look like the majority of the people that I knew. And, you know, our thoughts, you know, they're things. And so they speak without being spoken a lot of times. You can feel there's an energy about any disability in this society. And you have a sense of it without hearing the words. And you don't even understand why you feel an aversion to it. But you're picking it up from all around you. And so when I became blind as an adult, I had those same indoctrinated beliefs about blindness. Only now I'm talking about myself. I'm thinking about myself. So I've got to find a better way of thinking about blindness, because here it is, I'm talking about myself, or I'm going to succumb to those limited and limiting beliefs. And so it becomes a real expansion inside of you about what you're willing to think about yourself and other people so that you can actually grow and be able to manage who you are. I'm connected to an organization called the National Federation of the Blind as a chapter president. And I'm emphasizing the word of because this organization is run by blind people. And there are a lot of organizations out there, and they're for the blind. So I was fortunate enough to find out about the National Federation of the Blind and learn a bit about its philosophy about independence and that blindness is not the characteristic that defines you. So with the proper tools and training, we can do what we want. You know, we can live the lives that we want. You know, a lot of organizations are about overcoming blindness. And NFB is about, okay, I'm blind, now what? One of the things about the National Federation of the Blind, they've been around for 80 years. And, you know, a lot of times we're asking for something, but the members of the Federation have already figured out the solution. So they're actually helping to educate and teach, you know, what works. And that's why the National Federation of the Blind is so unique, because a lot of its members have figured out ways to allow independence, which is very different than, you know, handing people crutches. Advocacy is huge with the National Federation of the Blind. And so the pledge is about actively supporting the National Federation of the Blind in its efforts to achieve equality, opportunity, and security for the blind. Once a year, we have what they call the Great Gathering In, where we go to Washington, D.C. Of course, during the pandemic, we did not. But the national membership will decide on the kinds of issues we want to bring to the federal, the national level, senators and congressmen. You know, a lot of people are very interested in quiet cars because it's nice. But for a blind person in the environment, we need those sounds. It helps us to figure out what's going on around us and when it's safe for us to proceed and move further. So we've advocated with the manufacturers as well as the government to still have sounds so that we can know what's going on. If you're walking out in the street and you hear a vehicle come up, you can tell how well maintained the vehicle is by the way it sounds. You can tell if the brakes are faulty, you know, even though there are street lights, not all cars are going to, you know, obey the lights. And you could hear them coming. You can hear how fast they're moving. And all of that's very important. And not just for blind people. And that's the other part. When it's helpful to us, it's helpful to the society at large. When you think about parents with their children, and sometimes they get distracted gathering the kids. If they hear a vehicle, even though they don't see it because they're distracted, they're going to move differently with that child. But if they don't hear it and they're distracted, they may end up walking out in the streets. So we advocate and help people understand how to do what they're doing so that they can have what they want, but it also is what we want. You know, it's different stages of it. You know, I was coming through losing my sight. So there were different stages and I'm totally blind now, but I remember not being able to see people's facial features. And I really thought that I would never be able to meet a stranger and ever feel comfortable again because I could not see their features. I also thought that I was losing my hearing and I just discovered that I was using my vision to hear. And that was interesting for me. If I'd asked you, how are you? And you answered with your words, I realized I'd never really listened to what you said. I might have heard the sound of your voice, but I looked at you and came to my own conclusion. And so I started using my hearing and listening. And so people sometimes think when you lose a sense, a physical sense, that your other senses sort of kick in. And what does kick in is the greater need to use your other senses. It's always been there, but I wasn't focused on it. People like tactile kinds of things. And I had a piece of art in a gallery, and the whole theme of the show was called Ways to See. And so all of the artists, I think it was about 10 of us, everybody's work had to be tactile, and you had to create something that would invite people to see the work using all their senses. So people created things that had smells and sounds and, you know, everything you could touch. And it was very interesting. And so sighted people, it was really funny. They kept saying, really? I can touch it? I can touch this? You know, it was really, because people have been so conditioned through the years when you're in a museum, do not touch, do not touch. And they were, you know, they wanted to do it, but they were very hesitant. It's like, this must be a candid camera moment. Of course, I grew up in Baltimore, a place that many people who are from Baltimore know as Sandtown, western side of Baltimore. And then I ended up moving into what is now known as the Gwin Oak area. I didn't know until I was in school and someone told us that we were, quote unquote, living in the ghetto and that we were considered poor. Those were words that didn't have the feeling of the life that I was living. So I found that to be very interesting. And, you know, when you look around the world, it's a mindset that has just, you know, woven its way into the fabric of so many people, so many cultures. And it's you know, it's a lie, but it doesn't matter that it's a lie because it's having an effect on what people's lives are about. If I go way back to my earlier years, some of the first sounds that I remember, there was the Iceman who used to pull a wagon with a big block of ice on it, like 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and you could hear him pulling up his wagon, and he'd be just saying, "Iceman, get your ice here, Iceman." So the people in the neighborhood could hear. And the other thing that I remember hearing in the neighborhood is, you know, kids played outside. And so dodgeball was a big thing, and you could hear kids playing dodgeball. And then there was hopscotch and hula hoops. That was a big deal when I was growing up. You could do it on your leg, your arms, your neck. And you'd hear kids skating on the streets, and these were ball bearing skates. Ball bearings number 5s were the best. Another thing that we had in the neighborhood when I was growing up is there were lots of parades. You had majorettes, and every May, I think May 31st, Memorial Day, we would do a maypole kind of thing. And so we had like crepe paper, you know, attached to the flagpole, and somehow they taught us how to do a formation of several people, and it was an over and under kind of thing, and so we would cover the maypole. You know, we would dress up, and it was just fun. Gosh, one of the other sounds that we would hear, the neighborhood guys who loved to sing in the evenings when the street lights came on, because all of us had to be home and at least on the steps when the streetlights came home. And so those guys would be out there singing the most popular R&B songs. And they could really sing, too. They would stand under the streetlight and they would laugh and, you know, call for the people that they knew could sing and who was going to do which parts and that kind of thing. And so that was a lot of fun. Well, there was the little lady that lived across the street, Miss Maggie and her mom. And so I used to go to their house in the evenings because Miss Maggie's mom, Miss Annie, she loved Tarzan. So we would go over and watch Tarzan at her house. Then I had friends who lived all around. There was a Carolyn and an Antoinette, and then there was Sandra and her brother Ralph, who lived across the street. She was older, and she would braid our hair. And the Spencers, they owned the grocery store around the corner, and Mr. Roberts had the barber shop. And my school was down the street, and my neighborhood was rich with many different levels of social economic backgrounds. I mean, I knew that there were judges that didn't live far from me. There were lawyers. There were doctors. Black doctors had offices in our neighborhood, dentists. There were school teachers in the neighborhood. There were, you know, people who worked at General Motors and Bethlehem Steel. There were domestic workers. There were sanitation workers. There were people who worked for the city of Baltimore. And so you just had a plethora of people in the neighborhood. So it was just, it was rich. It was very rich that way. And then I went on to live in Harford County, Maryland, which is north of Baltimore. And probably, the mid-80s, I moved to Harford County. I actually lived in Harford County for about 15 years. And when my vision started to get so low that I could no longer drive, I ended up moving back into Baltimore City to our family's home, which is in the Gwin Oak area of Baltimore. And I came back to Baltimore because public transportation was a lot more accessible than living in Harford County. So the services to help me manage my blindness, not just medical, but also getting skills so that I could be more independent. And then getting to places that, you know, like doctor's appointments or even libraries and, you know, just to have a fulfilling experience in my life. It's an interesting life that we live, and we have so many choices. So I just want to make choices that make better sense to how and are related to how I feel. And I used to try to live my life from what I thought was right and wrong. And now I'm more inclined to live my life from how does it feel inside of me? And by that I mean when something happens, I'm trying to own what I think about it and then how I feel about what I thought. And if it feels good, you know, I'll do more of it. And if it doesn't feel so good, I'll try to soften it and sort of move into something that feels a little better. In a way, stories have been my life. Stories that I tell myself, the stories that I've been told, the ones that I took on and the ones that I rejected, all of them have had an impact on me. And so the details kind of create the story in some way. And sometimes I don't know the story until later. But if I look back, I recognize the story. It's sort of given me more clarity about how we have the ability to narrate the story, but we also can change the narration. And it moves you in a different direction because your attention and your focus is on the story in a different way. And that's, I guess that's the part of life that I'm examining is how do you change the narration in a way that you embrace it from your heart?
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Lori's Hands Community Voices. This episode was produced by Damilola Shabi, Katia Montero, and me, Jennifer McCord. Special thanks again to Marguerite Woods and to all the clients who spoke to us this season for sharing their time and stories with us. And thank you for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed the time you've spent with these clients. And while we're here at the end of another season of Lori's Hands Community Voices, the work Lori's Hands does happens year-round. If you'd like to stay connected, please reach out. You can get in touch with Lori's Hands by visiting lorishands.org, by emailing contact@lorishands.org, or on social media. Until next time, take care of each other.